what I learned a long time ago was, if you're going to do something on the web or anywhere, you know, if you have the chance to be number one, and there's no guarantee, but if you have the chance to be number one, that's an opportunity.
Welcome to another episode of Contrabass Conversations, your show covering life on the low end of the spectrum. I'm your host, Jason Heath, and I'm so glad you're here with us today. Visit our site at ContrabassConversations.com for all the details about what we're doing here. And I love to learn people's stories. And I love it if you reached out and told me your story. And you can do that by emailing me at feedback@ContrabassConversations.com. And I know you're going to love today's story featuring Corey Brown. Now, Corey's the founder and CEO of No Trouble, which is an online magazine dedicated to all things bass. And it's taken the world by storm in the past years and has dozens of regular guests and former contributors. Wonderful place to spend your time. I'm sure you've probably checked out No Trouble in the past. If you somehow have not, go there now. It's a great site. And it was so much fun chatting with Corey. And in addition to talking about No Trouble, we talked about the history of the site and so forth. We chat about Corey's early years in music, leaving music school for a career in graphic design, and how he got involved in building websites in the early 90s, kind of the Wild West of the web. We also talk about Corey running the official Jaco Pastorius website, how he ended up working for years with Seth Godin, creating Squidoo, and work-life balance, and many other topics. Corey's a super cool guy, has had a fascinating path in the creative arts, and I know you're going to dig this conversation. Here we go. All right. Well, we are on the line with Corey Brown, who is the founder of No Trouble. And it's such a thrill to have you on the show. Thanks for being here, Corey.
Hey, I really appreciate your time. Thanks for having me.
And let folks know a little bit about your early years in music. What was your first instrument?
My first instrument was double bass. And, you know, I've told this story before, but, you know, in the early 70s, I was lucky to have parents who were really into music. And so we had a lot of vinyl in the house. Mm-hmm. And I think it was probably like 71. I was probably like 3 years old at the time. My dad went out and bought one of those killer 70s stereos with the big speakers that look like furniture. And my father always cranks the bass on all his stereos. I mean, cranks it. Uh-huh. And I remember, you know, listening to all their records, and they had all this great stuff. And I remember like feeling the vibration in the floor, you know, because the bass was so cranked. And I was always fascinated with that. And, you know, I didn't really have an understanding about what instruments were what, but somehow I, like, you know, whether it was television or whatever, you know, got to understand, oh, those are drums and some of the other instruments. And so, but I always kind of gravitated towards that vibration that was obviously coming from the bass. And so years later, I was in the fifth grade, and I think it was the start of the year, and the music teacher came to our class and said, anybody that wants to join strings, you know, follow me. And so, you know, I really wanted to play an instrument at that point. So I jumped up and went down, and, you know, she had me try all four instruments. So she started me on the violin, hated it. Viola hated it. Cello, I thought was pretty cool. But then she handed me an upright bass, and, you know, I plucked the low E string, and it just connected. Yeah. You know, it just, I was like, wow, that's it. And so I was always drawn to that. And I immediately said, this is it. She says, let me see how big your hand is. She said, your hand's big enough. And man, I dragged that thing to and from school on the school bus, you know, every day. I was just really, really into it. Oddly enough, I switched to saxophone in middle school, but went right back to the bass short time after that. And that's been my primary instrument ever since.
That's a great image of you like hauling that bass out of the school bus. Everybody like,
oh my gosh. And it was a long walk to the bus stop, man. It was, you know, my dad always said, you know, we should figure out how to put wheels on the thing, you know, so you can ride it down the street. But I was that into it.
Well, I love that it's like the stereo and connecting with the bass on the stereo. I was talking to a guy recently, and he was talking about his teacher, Jeff Campbell, who teaches at Eastman, likes to say bass is the only instrument that has a knob dedicated to it on the stereo, right?
Right?
It's like you got your
right. That's right. Yeah. And thankfully my dad cranked it because who knows, you know, if he hadn't, you know, if he preferred the trebly side of things, you know, who knows what, you know, I might've picked up a violin or something.
Yikes.
Yeah. Right.
Now, when did you get into electric? When did that happen?
That was in high school. I think I was probably 14 years old. You know, I started out like most people with just a horrible, horrible electric bass. You know, the action was ridiculous and I saved my money. And I think when I was 15, by that point, I was like this huge Jocko nut. And the only bass that I could afford was this old 71 P bass that had a warp neck.
Oh.
So I took it to this guy who repaired instruments and I said, rip the frets out. You know, cause like everybody, it was his mid-80s, you know, early 80s, whatever. I just wanted to be Jocko. So I had him rip the frets out. And, you know, of course on a P, I just couldn't ever get the tone. And I mean, I couldn't have gotten the tone on a jazz either that he got, but that was it. That was my bass for a long time. That was my only bass, for a long, long time. And I still have it. It's kind of falling apart now.
Sure.
But, yeah.
You know, I wonder how many guys, cause I remember like I didn't do that to my P bass, but I came mm-hmm. so close. I wonder how many guys were inspired to go and pull out the frets and epoxy over the fingerboard.
Yeah. I think it had to have been a lot back then, man. I mean, I think a lot of people today, it's harder to recognize his genius because he started a whole movement that is followed. And so you have all these virtuosos on the bass who treat it as a solo instrument and everything today. But back then, I mean, it was just, I'm sure you remember, just earth shattering. And so I think, you know, everybody wanted to be like him. I knew a lot of people like that. So I saw a lot of fretless basses around.
Well, and I think it was on a recent Groove episode I was listening to. It's Mitch mentioned, like, is there any other instrument that's that closely associated with like one person? And I was trying to think of that. Cause like, if you say electric bass, like
right.
how even someone who doesn't know much at all about electric bass, like Jocko is going to be the name they know, you know, like if I think about like guitar, is there one person that you come up with? I mean, like Jimi Hendrix or,
sure,
but I mean, there's so many people, right? It's just interesting that like that impact that guy had on the music scene, but on the bass world. I mean, it's just.
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, I think if you're old enough, you remember, you know, I think it was somebody in the CC Riders that said, you know, there was bass before Jocko and there was bass after Jocko. And I think that if you're old enough to remember what that was like, and that's not to discredit anybody that came before him, because I mean, certainly there were tons and tons of great players, but he just turned it on its head, you know, just single-handedly, to me at least, transformed the instrument.
For sure. Well, I had the wonderful experience. You probably had this too, but like I've met this young electric bass guy. He's like 16, 17. And we were talking and this and that. It was at a music camp. And I said, well, you know, Jocko, right? Jocko. And he's like, who's Jocko? And pull out the iPhone, show him a video. You just watch that, you know, the eyes bug out.
Right.
You
know. Right. Absolutely. I think what's been great to watch, I think, is that with YouTube, And certainly now with the documentary, that people that, you know, the younger crowd who didn't experience it firsthand, like I did as an older guy, I think they're starting to appreciate it more than maybe they had before. Because, you know, there's a lot of current people to look up to, you know, now that have taken what he did and you know, evolved it into something even bigger and better. You know, that you look at Victor Wooten or Richard Bona, you know, what those guys are doing. And I think certainly the younger crowd, you know, they're looking at the musicians of their generation and seeing that. So, you know, I think he kind of got lost in the mix there for a while, but with, you know, social media and YouTube and like I said, the documentary now, I think people really appreciate more what he did.
Yeah. And that documentary is fantastic. And that just came out recently, right?
Yeah. It was November last year.
Yeah.
Thanksgiving weekend. Yeah.
Which is remarkable. So where did life take you after high school?
So I went to college and, you know, I decided to major in music. I didn't really kind of pick a specific major. I just decided just to go. And at some point I picked a composition and, you know, of course the safe thing at that point was education, but I knew that wasn't for me. You know, I knew a lot of my friends were, and they seemed well equipped for that kind of life and would be good at it. And for me, it just didn't resonate as a skill that I would have. And so I ended up deciding on composition. And what I figured was, well, shoot, if I'm going to major in composition, why bother with the degree? So I opted just to take music classes and not really any of the math, English, sciences or anything like that. And so, I lived in Texas at the time. And of course, being in Texas, the school to go to was North Texas. And so I transferred there my second year. And, you know, it was turned out to be a pretty colossal mistake for me. You know, what I soon realized being at North Texas was that if you're a really talented musician and got one of, in one of the lab bands, worked your way up, you know, that was, it was a place to go to be found, you know, more than, I don't think their composition department was their strength. I mean, I can't say for certain one way or the other, but, you know, it seemed to me like, you know, the school was about performance. And certainly they had 9 lab bands. And if you're in the 1 o'clock, you were the stuff, you know, that was major. A lot of recruiting happened out of there. And so I didn't really fit in that well. They had an attendance policy that the first university I went to did not have. And I was not a good, I wasn't good at attendance. Right. I had a 4.0, but they decided to kick me out for, academic suspension for a year, after my first year. And so at that point, I guess I was about 20 or so, 21 years old and a lot of soul searching. And I was like, you know, I don't want to go back there. And I started looking around at a lot of my friends and watching the lifestyle of the musician and how many lessons they had to give a week and gigs. And a lot of them were doing landscaping and all this sort of thing. And for me, it was a period of like real soul searching. Again, I didn't want to teach. I didn't think that was my strength. And I knew gigging wasn't going to be, you know, really any kind of solid bet. And, you know, the music industry was completely different at that point in time. You know, this was the late 80s and the dream was get a record contract, you know, like, which was, I mean, today with YouTube and Bandcamp and, you know, all these things, it's not that it's easy, but it's different. You know, you can build an audience that, you know, the labels aren't in control like they were back then. So for me, it was like a period of real soul searching. And I decided that I should probably think about a career and at least attempt something of a career. And for me, that meant doing something creative. And I have this like crazy family history in terms of, both my parents were artists. They met at the Corcoran Art School in DC. I have aunts who are in the art business. My father, my grandfather were in the art business, graphic design. And so, you know, I decided to pursue that. You know, to try that out. And so in 1990, I got an entry level job as a graphic designer. And I remember, you know, back then it was pretty overwhelming trying to learn everything. But I had my father and my grandfather and I would sit them down on the couch every Saturday and drink beers with them and just pepper them with questions about everything related to graphic design and printing. And, you know, these two were, you know, masters, both had spent their entire career in that field. And so I learned a lot in a very short time and kind of parlayed that into a career that I really enjoyed. You know, it was creative. It wasn't your normal desk job, kind of middle management kind of thing. It was long hours, but there's a lot of creativity to it. And so I kind of settled in that way. And, you know, when I look back, I think, man, how weird, what a weird path it was. But, you know, it all kind of makes sense now because in 95, I was an art director for a catalog company. And, you know, at that time, the web was just coming on. And usually when, you know, somebody wanted a website at the company, they went to one of two places. They either went to the IT department or they went to the graphic design department. And the company I was at didn't have an IT department. So the CEO came to me and said, I want a website. And this was, I think, April of 1995. You know, Amazon had launched. I mean, it was like, Yahoo was actually a directory, a list of sites that the two guys that founded Yahoo thought were cool. You know, it wasn't a search engine. So there were no books on how to learn how to make a website. You know, there was no market for it. And I remember, you know, I learned enough to release the first site and start getting hate mail from people that said corporations don't belong on the web. I mean, this is like, you know, to think about it now, it's just crazy, but you know, that's how it was. But I tell you that, at that point in time, I was really burned out with the graphic design business. And I thought immediately, this is the future. this is what I want to do. And I put everything into, you know, the web at that point. So that was what, a little over 21 years ago. And so I've been doing that ever since. And definitely my passion in terms of work. Yeah.
Oh man, so many questions. It's such an interesting path. I mean, like, I was talking to somebody recently, a composer, who was saying how similar composition and programming are in a lot of ways, just in terms of like logic, but creativity, but require. Do you see any pair? I mean, I'm sure you never could have predicted, being a composition major, that you'd end up doing that. There was no web, you know, a few years later.
Right.
But looking back, do you find some parallels between composition and programming?
Absolutely. You know, it's really interesting because in the 90s, when the .com boom was happening, you know, they couldn't find programmers. There was such a shortage because it was so new. And I remember reading about this study where they said that musicians were more apt to be good programmers than almost anybody else that were non-programmers. And if I remember the article correctly, you know, what they were basically saying was that as musicians, at least the ones that know how to read notation, it uses the same part of the brain. When you code, you use the same part of the brain you would to read notation, because reading music it's not English. You know, it's not a spoken language, but you're translating that into something. And so it was very much akin to programming. And so that, you know, I didn't know that until years later, but I tell you, most web shops that I've been involved in, you know, there's musicians all over the place, people that have a guitar at their desk or, you know, whatever. And it's very common. It's very common to see. And my brother, he's a bass trombonist. He actually made the 1 o'clock working on his master's at North Texas. He works with me. He's worked with me for a decade now. He's like this master coder. That's just another example of, you know, somebody who translated it very easily from one to the other. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. Cause it's like a combination of logic, but creativity that you need to, like, I'm just thinking on the music side of things. And that's very cool, man. I'd love to know, like, what was it now, having been in the business, you know, for the last couple decades, looking back on like that 1995 website and like what a person could do. What was that experience like in hindsight, like putting together this early website?
I mean, it would be hard for me to look at what we created back then, just because, you know, by any standard today, it would be atrocious. You know? But I think that, I mean, certainly the web has changed dramatically, especially when the social web came on. You know, first search became really important. So Google, you know, was it for many years, and, you know, obviously still a big part of it. But, you know, the social stuff really transformed it. But before that, you know, we didn't talk about SEO and search, and we didn't talk, you know, obviously there was no social anything. And so, you know, it was very limited. I think at the same time, you know, getting the early start, we didn't have a lot of competition, you know, that there weren't a lot of sites out there. And so, you know, I think that the thread that's always been interesting to me is the psychology, you know, the human behavior and, you know, what makes it tick. And so it's always centered around content for me, and, you know, having content be the draw to the site, and then, you know, figuring out what to do with that traffic once it gets there. But yeah, I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing how fast things have gone and how radical, you know, to think about like just Google from 2000 on, the only dominant player out there. And then all of a sudden Facebook comes on majorly strong. And, you know, so you have these two things now that, you know, where you used to just have one, and before you really didn't have anything. I mean, there was Yahoo for sure. And that was a big deal. You know, if you could get featured on Yahoo, that was a huge deal, but not quite the same as what evolved.
Oh man. Well, I even thinking about Facebook, like I remember when they first turned on the news feed and people were like up in arms, like, what is this feature? And that's just like the social experience that everybody has now, you know, talk about forward thinking.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. Do you ever internet way back machine any of your old projects? Just,
yeah, I have, you know, I said it's painful, but then I try to remind myself that we tried to push the envelope as much as we could with what, you know, but there was dial up modems. I mean, the video was out of the question, podcasts were out of the question, all this stuff, you know, it would have taken forever just to play your podcast, for example, you would have had to download it for a couple hours probably just to listen to it. So, I mean, it was like, very limited, very crude. It was all a building block, you know. It's like anything else. It's like, you know, learning your scales and then improvising later, you know. So I think, very similar in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah. When did you, now you built the official Jaco website, right?
But yes.
Was it mid 2000s that you were working on that?
I launched the first version at 2002, I believe, and ran that to about 07. And then I started up again, I think it was 2014. So the current version that's up now and the Facebook page and the store, I'm involved in all of that.
What inspired the page back in 02? What was the impetus behind that?
Well, you know, it's the official site, so it's run by his family. And I think it was around 98, you know, I was such a huge Jaco fan, and there was not much of a website up and running at that time. And I think it was maybe a coming soon page, in fact. And so I went on the domain records to find, you know, it was a P.O. box, and I used to mail them letters. And as it turns out, lots of people were mailing them the letters, and they were working on their own stuff, and they were like kind of dismissing, you know, this outside stuff. You know, they didn't know anybody, obviously, you know, were sending them letters, but, you know, I kept at it, and then, no response. And then around 2000, I got a copy of Bass Player magazine in my mailbox. I think it was January 2000, and Jaco was on the cover, and it was talking about Bob Bobbing's Portrait of Jaco, the Early Years Project. And in that article, there was a web address. And I went there and it said coming soon. So I reached out to Bob Bobbing, the producer of the Early Years box set, and said, hey, you know, I could help you with this web stuff, and ended up flying down to Fort Lauderdale, meeting with him. At that point in time, I discovered that he didn't have any of the packaging put together yet. And so being a print guy as well as a web guy, I told him, well, I could do that too. And so I think we worked, had it been at least 2 years that we worked on that thing. It was an 80-page booklet, a slipcase, 8-panel digipack. I mean, even the CDs had art on them, you know, like, you know, it was a major undertaking, but he and I created that whole box set, you know, the packaging for it. And that's how I got introduced to Jaco's family through Bob. And so it was 2002 when we launched the first official website, you know, and I got really busy with Squidoo in 2005. And by 2007, I think that's when I stopped working on the site. And then I took it over in 2014 again.
So you got involved with Squidoo 2005, you said?
Yeah.
Remember that? Maybe talk listeners through that, like how that happened, what Squidoo was and selling. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So most people, I think, are familiar with who Seth Godin is. You know, he's a best-selling author, I think 17 or 18 New York Times best-selling books in the areas of business and marketing. And Seth's first book, Permission Marketing, came out in 99. I read it and I was floored. And I was an instant Seth Godin fan. Just, you know, like before Amazon, I was parking in the bookstore parking lot the day his book came out to get it and would read it that day. So, you know, Seth had a blog. He blogged every day. And so that was part of my daily reading habit, just reading his posts. And it was early 2005 where he said he had a summer project. He was looking for people to help. And if you know have any of these skills, email me. So I emailed him and, you know, it was all like top secret. You know, he wasn't divulging what the project was, until we got up there. And it was Father's Day 2005 that I flew up to New York and met him. And he outlined his idea for Squidoo. And so the intent was that me and the three other guys he selected, and as well as him, would work over the summer to prototype what Squidoo was going to be. And that really didn't happen because there was a lot of other preliminary work that had to be done. And basically the site needed to be architected. So I worked like the equivalent of a second full-time job all summer.
Oh man.
You know, architecting Squidoo, writing 100-page spec on it and, you know, prototyping stuff. And at the end of that summer, Seth said, okay, we're going to do this and I want you to be the COO of this company and run it. And so I jumped at that. To me, it was like a really exciting concept. And I, again, kind of like in the way, you know, for younger people, how Jaco you know, may not be like what he was to me. If you think back to 2005, Google was it, and there was no social web. None. And so user-generated content, social web, Skidoo was one of the first platforms in that space. There was no Tumblr. There was no Instagram. There, you know, Facebook didn't even own Facebook.com in 2005. It was thefacebook.com. And I think they had a million members, and it was all, if you remember, you had to have a .edu email address.
I remember that.
You could only get in if you're a college student. No Twitter, no YouTube. I think Flickr was one of the only other sites out there for user-generated content. So we were definitely one of the first. And man, that project really worked. At our peak, by 2012, we were ranked 35th on the web for traffic, which was about 82 million visits a month. And just much bigger than anything I'd done to date, and I'm sure much bigger than anything I'll do ever again, partially by choice. Yeah. Because, I loved it. I loved it. I was, you know, we did it 9 years before it was acquired, but it was 9 years of 7 day a week. Get woke up in the middle of the night if the servers went down, you know, that kind of thing, that kind of life. So, you know, I wouldn't trade it for the world, but I like working fewer hours now.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, no trouble is a handful enough.
Man, I mean, like, that level of intensity just might be bonkers. I mean, I think about that a lot now, having moved out here to the Bay Area, where that's like the stereotypical, you know, that's what everybody is trying to do, and like 7 right. days a week and those. How did you avoid burnout? I mean, even if you're doing something that you love so much, that's like such a cool project, how did you keep from going crazy during that time?
You know, I think that, I mean, working with Seth was without a doubt one of the thrills of my career, by a long shot. And, you know, we were a company that was always tweaking, always inventing. And, you know, that's my favorite thing. Let's try new things. Let's see what works, what doesn't. And there, we had a real culture of that. We had a really solid team of people that embrace that culture and work fast and, so, you know, it was always kind of a lab for us to play with. And, you know, with that level of traffic, you could post something in the afternoon and collect enough data by the evening to decide if it was a good idea or not.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, it was fun. And, you know, Seth is so inspirational. And, I want to say also that a big part of the culture he wanted and he made sure was part of the company was a work-life balance. And so it wasn't that he made me or wanted me or expected me to work as much as I did. It was just, you know, that's what I did. But when I needed time off, I had kids, young kids at the time. And, you know, there was always no question, you know, anytime I wanted to spend time with the kids or, you know, something's going on or, and then I was famous for my 1 week at the beach vacation where I shut down everything, all devices and just floated in the Atlantic for 7 days and read books and cleared my head. And it was great because I never had a pushy boss who expected me to do something or be available on vacation or whatever. So there was a nice balance there when I needed it.
Well, I think that's something it's great to hear about that week long floating in the Atlantic, you know, deviceless. Mm-hmm. I think that's something everybody struggles with. Like, I know I struggle with that like always connected world we live in now. And I mean, in a way it's awesome. Like I can record a podcast, like walking down the street and upload it if I wanted to do that, you know,
right,
but like
right.
The dark side, of course, is like that always on, works. What have you done the last few years just to kind of maintain balance? Do you have any strategies or?
You know, it's definitely hard. I mean, when you put yourself out there, like you have with this podcast or like No Trouble, there are so many ways for people to engage you and you know, everybody chooses every avenue. So there's Facebook messages, both personally and through the page. And then there's, you know, email and there's texting and phone calls and, you know, it's just, you name it. So, you know, we get pinged pretty hard. I think that, you know, what I've learned over the years is you have to kind of dedicate a certain block of time to that stuff and you'll never get through your email. You'll never get through all these messages, but we get through everything eventually. But, you know, I think that there are times a day where I completely turn email off and all notifications and just say, you know, I'm going to focus on this and then I'll get to it when it's there because it's always there. And, you know, I think if we allow the interruptions all day, it's 6-7 o'clock at night and we're like, oh, I haven't touched my to-do list yet. And so I think that that's a lesson I learned a long time ago, you know, shut off this stuff and tell people, you know, if it's an emergency, call me, you know, cause that'll come through. But other than that, I'm ignoring all the other notifications and pings, you know, the phone just dings all day long.
Yeah. Well, I think I never realized just how distracting that was until a few months ago. And I would just like be typing or working on something and I'd see my phone buzz and I kind of look and go back. But man, that just kicks you out of that creative groove. If you're trying to do anything substantial, whether it's writing or recording or whatever.
Yeah, it's, and you know, I think so much of it is kind of unnecessary. I mean, with no trouble, it is necessary because we want to be approachable. You know, that's one of the things we take pride in. We do make it a point to reply to all the Facebook messages that come through our page and that sort of thing. But there's only so many cat memes and whatever that, you know, you know, a person can handle before they're like, you know, I'm going to get back to some important work here.
Well, I always think about that quadrant diagram, that's the 7 habits of highly effective people. And there's the urgent and important. And like so much of that falls into the urgent but not important, I think, is the quadrant.
Exactly. You know? Exactly.
And, yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. Well, maybe I'd love to hear. So you worked on the Jocko site and the Squidoo came along and maybe just tell folks about when you conceived of No Trouble and just how that all developed.
Yeah, I think that I thought of No Trouble and wanted to do it with a different name 10 years before I actually did it. You know, I really wanted to kind of merge my two passions in life, which were web and base. And I mean, it was pretty funny how, I mean, it was a very different time when I thought of the idea and we didn't have the kind of technologies that we have today that made it easier to build and maintain. And that was part of it. You know, it would have been extremely expensive in 2000 to build what we ultimately built. We launched in May of 2009. But what was funny about it was I had a lot of people in my network trying to talk me out of building it. And the reason they were trying to talk me out of building it was they said, it's too small. And I didn't care about that. You know, I never did create it to make money. I never created it to be big. I wanted it to be successful. I was a longtime reader of Bass Player magazine. And before that, you know, before Bass Player existed when I was a kid, all of us bass players subscribed to Guitar Player magazine and flipped to the back of the magazine for the 2 or 3 pages they dedicated to bass. And I loved it. But, you know, the print industry has gone through some real hardship. And that's, you know, in some cases still a very viable model, but it's changed. And the web is really hurt, you know, that industry. And when I looked around, even when I decided I'm going to do this, it was late 2008 when I decided to do it. I looked around and I didn't see an online magazine that, you know, I wanted to create. What I learned a long time ago was if you're going to do something on the web or anywhere, you know, if you have the chance to be number one, and there's no guarantee, but if you have the chance to be number one, that's an opportunity. And so, you know, like I wouldn't try to create a search engine or a social network today, you know, like the chances of being number one are slim to none. And certainly in 2008, I wouldn't have wanted to create a base forum, you know, because Talkbase is it. And so not that I wanted to do a forum, but that's an example of something that would have been foolish to even attempt, with the longevity and the notoriety of Talkbase. But in terms of online magazines, I didn't see anything that was like what I wanted to create. And so I thought, well, you can give it a shot. It doesn't cost a lot of money to do something like this. And so we started out and it was interesting because connecting it to the social web and the way we did it, and we built some tools that made that happen that are commonplace today, but weren't then. It really worked. And, you know, I was never a Facebook fan. I was always a Twitter guy and I tried to make the Twitter No Trouble thing pretty big. we had a Facebook page and it was on autopilot. I never, literally never did anything with it. And I looked over and I'd worked really hard on Twitter and we got like 400 followers. And I looked over at Facebook on autopilot, had 2,500 fans. And I thought, okay, I better go look at Facebook some more. So I started investing a lot more time over there and it grew and grew and grew. And I was pretty surprised by the growth and, you know, I still don't know how many bass players there are in the world, but you know, the numbers keep going up and, you know, I think that, you know, it's definitely been a successful project. But more importantly than that, connections I've made, the contributors that we have, you know, they're like family to me. The feedback we get from readers, you know, is so gratifying and that's what keeps me going. You know, it's not a moneymaker and maybe it will be one day, you know, but like I said, it's never been, how can I get rich off of this thing? It was much more about just kind of merging my passions together and you know, building something that, you know, hopefully other people resonated with. And so that's been the case. And I think that for me, the kind of magazine that I wanted to build was one that certainly covered the major guys. You know, if Victor Wooten has news, Stanley Clarke, Marcus Miller, you know, if there's anything about Jocko, of course, we're going to cover that. And I love those guys and I love, you know, seeing what they're doing. But because the web has leveled the playing field that allowed No Treble to be what it is, it's the same thing for bass players out there who are embracing YouTube and embracing social media and getting their art out there to the world. You know, we love discovering great talent all over the place. You know, so we feature a daily video. We do a reader spotlight every week and we do other things that give our readers the opportunity to get coverage alongside Victor Wooten, alongside these other guys. And to see like a video that might have 100 views and then we post it and then it has 10,100 views the next day, you know, it's such a win-win-win, right? Because to me, it's like this great content and I didn't have to come up with that music every single day. They get, you know, all these eyeballs on them and the readers dig it. And I'm thinking, you know, this is a thing of beauty, right? This is really fantastic all the way around. And so then I've had a lot of people come to me and say, you know, you really put my music on the map. You know, I've sold a bunch of albums as a result and got all these subscribers now. And, you know, I just love that aspect of it. I just love it because there's a lot of talent out there that people didn't know about historically because, you know, the labels were in charge. And so, you know, you look at Xander Zahn, you look at Aaron Gibson, you look at Steve Lawson. Steve was already doing amazing things. I mean, all those guys did amazing things in terms of putting their stuff out there and building an audience. And I think we helped in some way. You know, Wolfpack, those guys, you know, told us that we really helped them at the beginning sell a lot of their album. And I don't want to overstate anything here. Like, you know, these guys, they're doing what you're supposed to do, which is putting art out there to the world, working hard to get exposure and, you know, build an audience. But when we can play a role in that, that's the most exciting thing to me. My favorite thing every week is the reader spotlight, you know, just because that's what we're about.
Yeah. So that's so cool that you do that reader spotlight. And I mean, man, that's like that. Talk about a win-win. That's really what it is. Because the beauty of this open playing field is that we can get our message out there and we can put our art out there. But the big challenge is discoverability, right? And it makes me so sad sometimes when I see like just the most amazing performance. A guy that I was interviewing for the podcast, I went on this video and it's this amazing Daft Punk arrangement that he'd done. It sounds like it's like using a looping pedal, but it's not. It's just upright bass doing this. And it had like 280 views. I'm thinking like, man, 280 views. This thing should have.
Yeah, I know. I know. Well, it happens on No Treble sometimes too, where we'll put a video out and I'm thinking, this is just killer. And for whatever reason, maybe because the bass player is not recognizable in the photo or whatever, and it just doesn't get the love. And I'm like, you know, like if you just watch this, you know, you'd become an instant fan. But yeah, I mean, it's great. It still stuns me, like that example, you know, 200 views on something that terrific, but hopefully we'll find it, feature it, and hopefully it'll do something.
Yeah.
You know, like, so yeah.
You mentioned this earlier, and this is something I've wondered about a lot. It's like, how many bassists are there out there really? And I know that, like, who knows, but man, do you have any, can you even get it like in a range? Do you think, are there 100,000? There got to be at least 100,000.
Yeah, at least that. I mean, we get about 280,000 visits a month on okay. our treble, and it's definitely over 100,000 people visiting unique a
okay.
month.
Okay.
So, I mean, are they all bass players? Probably not, because somebody shares a video and, you know, their non-bass playing friends might come watch it. But I gauge things more on our how-tos and the traffic on those, you know, where like bass lessons and things like that, which, you know, no non-bass player would probably want to click on.
Probably not.
But, you know, we've had months where we've hit 250,000 visits a month. And again, you know, are they all bass players? Who knows? But I have no idea. I really don't. I remember when I did some research before I started No Trouble, and this was back when I originally thought of the idea back in 99, 2000, I did some research and I think it was something about the census. For whatever reason, they knew how many guitar players there were in the country. And somebody estimated that for every 10 guitar players, there's one bass player. And, you know, it seemed kind of high to me, but they said there was 14 million amateur guitar players in America. So that means if that math is true, there was 1.4 million amateur bass players in America. I don't buy it, but
right.
You know, really, I don't know. If there's 1.4, man, we got a lot of work to do.
We got, right? well, yeah, that's just America, right? I mean, like, even if that number's high, you got, you know, and another thing you mentioned that I've thought a lot about, it's interesting that you brought up, is like that Twitter, Facebook, because I love Twitter too. I find Twitter super useful, but it's interesting that you've had the experience that like you really get the traction on Facebook, or you have. Do you have any speculation why that is, or why that?
You know, I don't know what Twitter's numbers are now in terms of daily active users, but my guess is that Facebook is way above that. But, you know, I think that if you look at like the tech world, I read a lot of tech blogs, you know, I read a lot of, you know, technology stuff on the web. And when you look at, I pay attention to the counts on the share buttons.
Mm, sure.
And in the tech world, you know, Twitter dominates and Facebook is quite secondary. But for whatever reason, we've always been the opposite of that. You know, Facebook dominant, Twitter, you know, a distant second. And so, you know, I don't really know. I mean, I know there's plenty of bass players on Twitter. I don't think that when you think about, like, if you're a bass player and you want to, if you're part of your social activities is marketing, you know, I just think that Facebook probably offers better stuff. You know, you see, like, I'm amazed. We embed a video on our Facebook page, or, you know, a lot of the like guys out there that do that. The counts are just staggering, you know, on Facebook. And I think on Twitter, it just doesn't have that same kind of mechanism or viral loop, I think, that Facebook has. I mean, I don't know about you, but I get stuck in that vortex sometimes every night of swiping through Facebook. And, you know, you watch one video and there's five related videos. And
yes. Yeah. Me too. Me too. I have to try to put, I've been starting to put my phone by the door when I walk in sometimes at night.
Right. Just
but yeah, I've spent many an hour doing just that.
Yeah. And I don't feel like the same kind of activities happening on Twitter. You know, when I'm scrolling through Twitter, I'm just scrolling and, you know, you hit the heart, you know, if any tweet you like, and you just kind of keep going, and, you know, it's not quite the same.
Well, I was also wondering about the contributors that you've assembled for No Trouble. Like, how is that all structured? Did they come on kind of organically over time? And do people publish? Do you have like is it just kind of people publish when they got something to put out, or how do you organize all of that?
Well, the growth of the contributor team has definitely been very organic. A lot of our contributors have come, they were readers, and readers that we connected with on a deeper level, or met at NAMM or whatever. We definitely have a very set editorial calendar. So like Ask Damien Erskine's every week, every Wednesday at 3:30 Eastern. Ariana Capp's Talking Technique is every other Monday. We have Ted Bliss Gould now. He's doing Talking Style. He's been once a month. Looks like he's going twice a month. And then Ryan Medora. she does two different columns for us every other Friday. And so, you know, you get the picture. It's very structured in terms of, you know, we have these anchor points, which are our columnists and lessons. And Rufus Philpott just debuted his first thing. So, you know, we have slots that are dedicated to those people. And it's at a regular, you know, Donovan Stokes. I don't want to miss anybody. there's a lot. So each contributor has their slot and their cadence. And so, and then, you know, we have the daily video, and then we cover new albums, we cover new gear, we cover new stories and things of that nature. And then we have things like the Reader Spotlight, which is every Tuesday. You know, all the slots are pretty much filled in terms of what that is, you know, what time of the day and what day of the week. So we have a very regular schedule in that. And so the contributors, you know, all work towards that schedule. The thing that I wanted to do, and I think the thing that is probably what makes most people the happiest, is that I didn't want to limit No Trouble and say, okay, Damian, write about this. Ryan, write about that. You know, these are bass players. These are talented bass players. They're knowledgeable. They have their own opinions and insights and everything else. And so I say, write about what you want to write about. And it's great because I think it brings great diversity. You know, like I always joke with Kevin, I'm not a metal guy. Kevin Johnson is definitely my go-to guy, the managing editor. He's been with me almost since the beginning. And there's no way I could have done it without him or really anybody else I mentioned. But he's a linchpin. And Kevin's this metal guy. And I always joke with him saying, I can't tell the good metal from the bad metal. So, you know, like in the early days of No Trouble, you know, there was a lot of jazz videos and stuff, and we were attracting a lot of jazz fans, and people started saying, well, what's with all the jazz all the time? It's like, well, you know, I'm the only guy picking.
Right.
So now we're getting, you know, we've gotten a lot of diversity with that, which is great. You know, like I don't want to limit anything. There's a lot of diversity out there, and I want us to represent that. So with all these contributors, the diversity is definitely, I think, there.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Well, that's great. And what a lineup. And Donovan's a friend of mine, and he's an interesting guy. He's kind of like a heavy metal guy, but for the upright bass in a way, you know, like really, really wild.
Yeah. When I first met him, I was stunned at what he was doing with a double bass. I was like, man, this guy's pioneering some stuff. Has been doing it for a long time. He's a beast. And I was very lucky. He actually, that relationship is how I found Kevin, because I live very close to, or I did at the time, live very close to Shenandoah University, where Donovan teaches. And I had reached out to him to see if he wanted to contribute. And he did. And then I said to him, like, man, I need help. Do you have any double bass students who are like super reliable and, you know, I could talk to? And he introduced me to Kevin, and that's how the Kevin relationship started. So Kevin was still studying when he started with No Trouble, and since graduated. So,
man, you know, I don't usually have any set questions for any of these. I just sort of talk, but like I sort of started asking people, and it's like, it's one you hear in a lot of podcasts, but I love it. It's a great, and you might have a good answer, but like, if you could go back to your, let's say, 20-year-old self, and having done all the things you've done and the career trajectories that you've taken, got any advice for that 20-year-old Corey?
Oh man. Well, the 20-year-old Corey got thrown out of college. You know, it's tough because I think that the way my career went, you know, I was always going to get thrown out of college because I never fit in with the lines and the, you know, whatever. I think that I would call myself like a meat and potatoes bass player. Uh-huh. And I think that if I had to go back, knowing what I know now, and certainly what I've learned from other people and our contributors and everything else, I think I would have probably spent more time broadening my horizons on the bass. The career really took over, and there was a long period of time where I didn't touch a bass, and I got back into it. And I think that would be it, because the harder I work, if I pick up a bass at the end of the day, you know, I just naturally feel better.
Yeah.
And I kind of lost that for many years while I was trying to build my career and trying to pay the bills. In terms of the way my career went and panned out, it was hard. I don't have any regrets. You know, I'm glad the way it turned out. I guess most people would say, try to talk this kid into going to class and making the attendance portion of the grade. But, yeah, I don't, I don't know how that would have benefited me one way or the other. Right. You know, I'd have a composition partial degree.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Well, and doing something like No Trouble, I mean, man, talk about a great way to broaden your horizons. You know, like, I mean, that's the thing that's so amazing about this social media, whatever you want to call it right now, with YouTube and with, and that's what I find, like, doing this podcast myself, like, it sort of, I'm discovering all these new projects and new styles and new, and I think it's totally broadened my horizons. I think I was like meat and potatoes bass player, like from the orchestral side, but very much like not, I'm so much more kind of curious these days after that.
Oh yeah, I tell you, my music collection has grown more thanks to No Trouble than probably any period before that. Yeah, and my, you know, downloading these transcriptions and stuff and just trying to work through them. And this stuff, the way the bass is gone, man. Stuart Clayton does a lot of our transcriptions, and he picks like ones that I'm like, man, this could take me a year if I can even get it. But yeah, so but it's fun and. I'm always up for a challenge, you know, that, but yeah, you know, what you're talking about is dead on. Just the discovery part of it is extraordinary.
Well, thanks again, Corey, for being on the podcast. So much fun to hang out with you online here. And folks, check him out online at notrouble.com or coreybrown.me. And again, thank you so much for listening. I am so thrilled to have you here. I really do appreciate you listening to these episodes. And you could be doing a lot of things with your time. And I'm honored that you're taking the time to listen to these. And I know it's time well spent. And I appreciate it. And Corey appreciates it. And it's just exciting times we're living in. And I have so much fun talking about these kind of things, geeking out on bass, geeking out on life, practicing, what's going on in the world. It's just such a thrill for me to do this. And thanks again for checking it out. And be sure to check out our website for more information about the mission of this podcast. It's contrabassconversations.com. And we'll see you again soon for more life on the low end of the spectrum.